رقم واحد الشعب السوري ما بينزل بيان رقم واحد اكيد هيك ما حنضل بيان رقم واحد من حرام بلشت البشاير بيان رقم واحد للشعب السوري ساير.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And there have been meetings in the Gulf in Doha that have concluded with a newly organized National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, headed by Moaz al-Hatib, who is a former imam of the big mosque in Damascus. The opposition, of course, in Syria have been notoriously fractured. And lately, I understand the New York Times carried a story recently saying that they were getting more and more unpopular within Syria itself because of the excesses of some of the Salafists, the so-called al-Qaeda types, executing prisoners, etc. What is this new organized opposition likely to achieve, do you think?
Well, the most important thing, and the reason why Hillary Clinton demanded that it form, was that it's going to replace the Syrian National Council, which the United States has always viewed as unrepresentative of the opposition. There's several problems with the Syrian National Council that this new group is intended to fix, one of which a vast majority of its members were in exile, and many hadn't been back in Syria for years. Secondly, there was really no connection between the civilian leadership of the Syrian National Council and the military leadership on the ground. And this is a real problem right now in particular because over the last year or so, the rebellion has become increasingly militarized. So the civilian components of the opposition are being or have been shoved aside. Now they will be represented. Now the military will be represented along with the civilians. This will allow the West, the United States, the Western allies, but also Saudi Arabia and Qatar to funnel aid directly into the opposition, as opposed to the way they had been doing it before, which was, first of all, covertly on the part of the West, but also in terms of each country, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, focusing in on those members of the opposition that it particularly enjoyed warm relationships with to the exclusion of others. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it was the Salafis. In the case of Qatar, it was the Muslim Brotherhood.
So what's happening, though, with Syria in terms of there were some mortars fired in the Golan Heights into Israel, and Israel retaliated. And there also there was an airstrike the Syrian Air Force struck very close to the Turkish border. Is Assad trying to, bring in foreign powers? Because he's been saying his excuse for what he's doing is that he's fighting a war against foreign intervention when there's no evidence that that's the case. Is he trying to create evidence of foreign intervention?
Well, we don't know exactly what's going on in the heads of the people who are right now running Syria. I would very much doubt that they do want to get into some sort of large-scale conflict, for example, over the Golan Heights. They also undoubtedly do not want to take on the Turks by themselves either. The question is how, well, the issue that's being raised is whether or not these provocations are being made so that there would be, let's say, some form of counterstrike to unite Syrians against Assad, against either the Turks or the Israelis. I'm not really buying that. I think that perhaps the professionalism of the Syrian military is probably overestimated. The centralization of the Syrian military is overestimated as well. Local unit commanders, the ones that are trusted, of course, have more of a say in what they're going to do against the opposition than it's first apparent. So it's very possible that what's going on are local operatives, mistakes that are being made, or perhaps even the possibility of the opposition itself trying to create a larger conflict.
But I imagine neither the Israelis or the Turks are reflexive enough to be baited into responding.
Well, the Israelis have already responded, of course.
With
they
knocked
out an artillery position after a second day of mortar rounds being fired over the border. So it's one of those things that I don't think there's going to be a dramatic escalation. And what I found very surprising so far is the way the Turks have stood down after provocation in particular. But I don't think there's going to be large-scale confrontation between either Turkey and Syria or Israel and Syria.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA, where he specializes in Greater Syria, and he's the author of The Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. I mentioned, James, the New York Times recently carried a fairly sobering story of how the Syrian people, who obviously would like to get rid of the dictator, at the same time they're afraid of chaos, and we're told that it's not just the Alawites that support the regime, but also the Christians as well. But apparently there's been some revulsion against some of the tactics on the part of some of the elements of the so-called Free Syrian Army, particularly the Salafist elements who executed captured soldiers. What's your understanding of how the Syrian people are viewing the opposition or the uprising or the rebels or whatever you want to call them?
Well, I think it's important to just step back a second and look at how the regime has ruled in Syria. One of the things that they've employed has been what the Arab Human Development reports call the legitimacy of blackmail. It's actually legitimacy by blackmail. And what they basically do is they tell their populations, their supporters in the population, which their natural supporters would be religious minorities, such as the Alawites, who make up predominantly the ruling group, and Christians as well, but also Druzes and Kurds and what have you, that if we go, you're in real serious trouble. You're going to be wiped out completely. They've played this card on multiple occasions. They're not the only ones, by the way, in the Middle East that do that. The Bahrainis have done it, and even the Egyptians have done it in terms of their own Christian population. So the regime itself has completely played the sectarian card and upped the ante at several points by calling the opposition, all of the opposition, Salafists, by calling all of the opposition members of the Muslim Brotherhood, terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. They not only militarized the conflict, the government not only militarized the conflict, the government also sectarianized the conflict. It made it into a sectarian dispute by calling out the opposition as members of Islamist organizations, by accusing them of being Salafis, and by seeking support, hoping that the minority communities would circle their wagons around the regime. As a result, we see the situation that we have now. For example, the sectarianization began with Alawite militias known as Shabiha, who deliberately massacred villages that were predominantly Sunni or entirely Sunni. Then what you get was, of course, tit-for-tat retaliation back and forth. Then, of course, there's been the infiltration into Syria, mainly from Iraq, but from other places as well, of a variety of jihadis. There is an indigenous jihadi movement, the Jabhat Nusra, but there's also probably fighters who got their training elsewhere who have infiltrated back into Syria. So what we see right now is a very, very sectarianized situation. So it's not surprising that people would look at the fighters and say, my God, you know, they're committing as many crimes as the government. Why won't they just give it up? There's something in addition to that, though. The tactics that have been used, not just the killings, but the tactics, overall tactics that have been used by the opposition has led to its declining or less popularity than you would expect. What they do is they go into sections of cities, they take over sections of cities, they have no chance of holding territory, but then the government comes in and levels those sections of cities. And this, we've seen this, for example, in various parts of Aleppo, in the main souk in Damascus. The business people in that souk, who are mainly Sunni Muslims, begged the opposition not to go into the souk, not to take over the souk, not to attempt to fight for the souk, simply because they feared that this was exactly what was going to happen there. So it's a combination of sectarianization and also the tactics that are used that have diminished the popularity of the opposition.
So when the new leader of this opposition umbrella group, the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, that was unveiled on Sunday in Doha, the leader, the former imam, Mr. Hatib, he says, "We demand freedom for every Sunni, Alawite, Ismaili, Christian, Druze, Assyrian, and the rights of all parts of the harmonious Syrian people." What's his rhetoric likely to do in terms of what you just said, with the war-weary, paranoid people who've witnessed the destruction of one of the great wonders of the world, the souk in Aleppo, and this tactic of going into territories, taking areas and then having them pulverized by the Syrian military, which in turn makes them unpopular with the very people that they're trying to liberate?
The rhetoric has a nice cooling effect. I'm not quite sure it's going to have any real effect on the ground, though. I think what's more important, though, is by putting somebody like this on top, and he's very well respected. The position, first of all, of Imam at the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus is a very important symbolic position, and he's very well respected in Syria. By putting somebody like this in charge, and then by having, for example, his vice presidents being somebody who actually performed heroically during the brief Damascus spring of 2000, and then a member of the Atassi family, who a woman, as a matter of fact, as another vice president, maybe even a Kurd. This gives the impression of a overall umbrella group that's very inclusive. And this will allow the West to actually funnel in the sort of assistance that these people have been asking for. By doing that, what it'll allow the West to do is to target the assistance to those groupings that they think will be more malleable towards Western ideals. That is, not the jihadis, not the al-Qaeda people, et cetera, et cetera.
So is this likely, though, this new group with this imam that's highly regarded at the head of it, will the Syrian people, given the nature of state media propaganda, where are they getting the information from? Are they aware of this change? And is it something that they're all going to understand and perhaps rally behind?
Well, the question is whether or not they're going to get the information is a fairly simple answer to that. Yes, they will, of course. The regime does not have a completely effective control over the propaganda. I mean, every time I visit friends in Syria, they listen to Voice of America and they listen to Radio Israel and various other stations as well. Whether they believe it or not is another question. But they do have access to information in Syria. And, of course, now with the new social media as well, electronic media, there is more and more access, including Al Jazeera. So the access is certainly there. The question is, what are people going to do with the information once they get it? Now, there is a possibility that it'll work itself out in the following way. If money gets funneled in through this group, groups that are want to get hold of that money or the arms or the non-lethal aid that's going to be filtered in through it are going to have to submerge themselves within this group as well. So what this means is that there's going to be a premium on joining this group, and this might allow it to succeed. The problem is that the political ambitions of this group are not well known. We don't really know what the overall program is. We do know that the formation of this group has made it so there will be no political solution to what's going on in Syria. They have already stated that they are not, that one of the fundamental objectives of this group is not to hold a national dialogue with Assad, which means that the only way that this thing can be resolved now is going to be through military.
Well, the Russians, of course, James Galvin, are insisting on a negotiated settlement. And if that's a non-starter, I noticed that the Chinese, who had an observer at the meetings in Doha, they seem to be moderating their position and they're not quite as pro-Assad as the Russians are. Is that a correct reading of that?
I think that what we have to do is step back and look at under what conditions a political settlement would be possible. And I'm not ruling out entirely a political settlement, but what I am ruling out is a political settlement being likely. And there's a reason for that. There are two conditions that have to be met before there can be a political solution. The opposition and Assad have to simultaneously see the situation as being stalemated, that they can't possibly make an end run militarily or any other way, and they have to start talking to the opposition, or to the government. That's number one. Second precondition is at the very same time, outside powers, United States, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, have to view the situation also as stalemated and also have to stop viewing Syria as a zero-sum game, where a loss for Iran, for example, would be a win for Saudi Arabia or vice versa. What that means, of course, is that they would not at that point pump in more weapons to their side that they think is going to win, but instead push their side towards a negotiated settlement. These two conditions, that everybody on the ground inside Syria views it as a stalemate, everybody outside views it as a stalemate also, are highly unlikely to be met.
So just in terms of this stalemate and the agony of 36,000 people being killed, that's the official statistic. I think you have to add to that all of the people that were arrested. If you've been disappeared by the Assad regime into the Muhabarat's prison system, I don't think you're going to come out, are you?
There has been a revolving door. Part of the way they actually do this thing is, as Lenin once said, the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize. I have a friend, for example, who was arrested by the government several years ago, taken to a prison, actually in a very nice residential area, the prison was in Damascus, tortured, lost all of his hair, had scars, and then he was released. And he wanted to know from the prison officials what he can and cannot say so he wouldn't be swept up again. And they said, tell him everything. We don't care. Let him know. So that's the whole idea behind, these mass arrests, et cetera. But let me add to the bleak picture. Before the uprising began, there was about 1.3 million internal refugees, people who came from the countryside into cities because the Syrian economy is highly dependent upon agriculture, and it hadn't rained in Syria for 4 years straight. Okay, so you had a mass population movements taking place. Now, add in another 1.5 million people. So we're up above 10% of the population here that are internally displaced refugees. United Nations numbers are anywhere between 400 and 500,000 external refugees on top of this. The Syrian economy is a mess, particularly after the 17 rounds of EU sanctions, for example. It's a very, very bleak picture about the way Syria is going to emerge from this confrontation.
Well, just in closing, James Galvin, the British and the French have indicated that they may consider arming the opposition, and clearly they've been outgunned by the Syrian military, and it's pretty obvious that they haven't been getting much in the way of sophisticated weaponry, particularly anti-aircraft weaponry. Is that going to change?
That I can't tell you. I don't know exactly what's going on in the councils. I would assume that probably will change, considering the sort of tactics that the government has been using, which has been, frankly, they don't do house-to-house combat. What they do is they bomb from the air or shell from the ground whole districts of cities that have been taken over by the opposition. So it's very, very possible that a tilt would have to include anti-aircraft or even anti-missile batteries.
Well, my understanding from field investigator for Amnesty International, who has made several trips inside of Syria, she was telling me recently that the Syrian government's tactic is that all of the liberated area, they shell randomly just to terrorize the population and punish them for accepting the rebels.
Right, exactly. And there's something else that's involved in this as well. Like, for example, if you remember the Battle of Bab Amru in Homs, took place last year, shelled the district, destroyed it. It had been a predominantly Sunni district. Now what they're doing, what the government is doing, is they're rebuilding it and they're making it into an Alawite district within the city itself. In other words, what the government is doing is deliberately sectarianizing space within Syria.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Down.